Good morning. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show, going into hour two of this show. Calvin, I think we have a caller, John Hopkins, a friend of mine who's calling in. Is that right?
That is right. He is online.
Hey, John, how are you?
Hi, Sandy.
So I asked John to call in because we're going to talk about some health care issues. But John's like, he's an old friend of mine. And John actually could do that ad. What is it? The most interesting man in the world. That John might fit into that category. And I'll let all of you judge that later. But John, actually, a little bit about your background, because some of it's kind of interesting. Didn't you grow up in American behind the Iron Curtain, sort of? I mean, weren't you raised in Yugoslavia?
I did. My father was in the Foreign Service in the State Department in a branch called the Voice of America. And in 1969, we moved to Belgrade, Yugoslavia, as part of setting up a bureau there. It was the first Voice of America bureau in Eastern Europe. To date, all of them had been based in Western Europe, but made trips to Eastern Europe. So we were in Belgrade for about six and a half years, and at a time where Yugoslavia was still a coherent country, and Joseph Tito was the president and held these disparate republics together as a sort of a bulwark against the Soviet Union, really, at the time, because they were surrounded by Hungary and Romania and Bulgaria.
Yeah,
and
that's right. Yugoslavia was Czech Republic. It was sort of a hybrid communist country, right? I mean, it was nominally communist,
yeah,
but not particularly committed to the Soviet Union. It was sort of, but was it? It was considered the other side of the Iron Curtain, or maybe not. Was it a?
It was truly a hybrid. That's a great description of it. It was this interesting potpourri of socialism, communism, and a nice peppering of good old-fashioned Westernism, and partly because of its proximity to Italy, and it was a it really sort of came together after World War One, and in response to the Soviet threat, they pulled together and formed this. Yugoslavia means Union of the South Slavs. And formed this country, but it had a strong influence because it did fight on the side of the Allied powers and was a formidable force against the Germans.
So you went to your family sent you to prep school in Switzerland, I guess, and then you came to UW. That's right. So your introduction to Wisconsin was through the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, and actually, that is true. I went to both undergrad and graduate school at University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Doing
in the 1970s.
A computer jack, right?
That's correct. Both undergraduate and graduate degree in computer science.
Yeah, so you know, it's hard to believe that a guy who's a computer scientist I would label one of the most interesting people in the world, because it seems like that would be an oxymoron, right? So.
Yeah, usually you lose people at a cocktail party when you
because you're looking at their shoes and they don't know what yeah. So then after school you went to work for GE Medical, and that was your introduction into the medical world, correct? I mean,
that is correct. Yeah,
And then after
worked on the MRI system, early MRI, magnetic resonance imaging systems.
Yeah. And then after that, you went into software businesses yourself. Now, one of the things that I wanted to have you on now about is the one of the businesses you're currently involved with involves providing service, computer service of some sort to the medical industry. Can you explain it? But I think one of the most interesting attributes of it is that, well, where are the computer jacks that you're employed with? They're physically located, not in the United States, right? Your partners?
Well, our company has offices both in the United States, and then we have a development group in Nepal, in Kathmandu. We have about 48 developers in Kathmandu. And it gives us several advantages. There is a cost advantage, and then there's also the fact that we can be doing stuff at night for clients so that it's ready in the morning. They're 12 hours ahead of us. So we basically have, you know, this 24-hour coverage, which is advantageous to our clients.
Yeah. So you are, in fact, a, a manifestation of the of globalization, right? I mean, 30 years ago, this wouldn't have been dreamed of, or 40 years ago, and today it's pretty commonplace. Like, you know, we all know, because sometimes when we call up FedEx to find out where our package is, the person is talking to us from India. Right?
That's very true. I mean, you and a lot of medical support is done in the Philippines, for example. For a number of reasons, you start to get these centers of excellence. The same thing is happening in Kathmandu. We have a large number of people now who know the American healthcare system pretty well, and there are several fairly good-sized software companies now that, that address this. There's a lot of software to be written in the medical field, and it's cost advantageous to companies to use teams in those areas, and also just availability. You know, you hear about layoffs at Amazon and Facebook and Google. A lot of those people are not in the deep tech, or if they are, these were people that needed to move on anyhow. Either they had lost interest or they just didn't have the skills. So we have the advantage that we can attract very strong talent in the area and retain them. And we are able to get the same quality you get in the United States.
Well, interesting. So, you know, from the healthcare standpoint, I was talking in the first hour about the failure of regulation and the power of K Street and the extent to which K Street has been treated like courtesans and are able to accomplish as they want. You know, they have their way. And mm-hmm. clearly one of the results of that has been our broken healthcare system, because clearly there are special interests that have an extreme amount of sway in Washington and has caused our healthcare system to be created in such a cockamamie fashion. You know, we have third-party payers. Mm-hmm. I presume it's been your experience that the healthcare insurance industry has a great deal of sway in terms of calling the dance.
Oh, yeah, it certainly has. And I think this is the challenge that we run into all the time, which is that the business side of healthcare, as opposed to the clinical side, you know, when you go in to see your doctor and they've got their stethoscope out or they're taking your blood pressure, that we call the clinical side of medicine. The non-clinical or the business office side, where claims are processed and people decide plans and people are given pre-authorizations, all of that non-clinical but business office side is really where most of the money is involved. And that's the side that we deal with. And the issue here is that the insurance companies are the ones calling the shots, and yet nobody in that insurance company is part of your visit to the doctor. Nobody's really part of that decision, and they are not providing the service. They are simply making the decisions about what's going to be paid for and at what rate.
I mean, my sense from the outside, my sense from the outside looking in is that one of the things wrong, I mean, the biggest thing wrong with our system is nobody, all the incentives in the system suggest that nobody cares about the patient. Nobody, there's no particular vested interest that cares about the wellness of each patient or the wellness of the public. In fact, most of the incentives are to treat illness. And so the more illness there is, the more essentially the world is, our world is incented towards a public that has a great deal of illness so that there's more to treat. There's no mm-hmm. particular part of the system that has any interest in cost control. Even the insurance companies seem to be benefited from having higher costs that are carried through in their premiums. And the last thing I've noticed just from my interactions with medical care professionals over the past decade is that nobody cares about professional satisfaction, that people who went into doctoring for the purpose of experiencing the edification of being a doctor are being robbed of that because they're being allowed 5 minutes with their patient. They're being required to mm-hmm. to have a head count during the day rather than a wellness outcome analysis. And so we've got nobody that's happy with the system. Patients aren't happy. Providers aren't happy. And our public is spending an enormous amount of money on it. Is that a pretty
clear? Yeah. Yeah, just to refresh, you know, the operative number that people often toss around right now is that we spend about $4.2 trillion a year on healthcare-related activities. Now, that isn't just going to the doctor or just having a colonoscopy. That also includes things like buying a walker or, you know, wellness programs and stuff like that. But it's still an enormous amount of money, and we pay the most in the world, and yet we're ranked about number 10, depending on how you rank us, in the world for outcomes. Now, it's still pretty good, but, you know, we could be doing a lot better considering we spend significantly more than the next four countries combined.
Well, and by outcome, though, are we talking about outcome in terms of the wellness of the public, or are we talking about the outcome when people actually get health care? Because my experience today talking to people is that even people who have insurance are afraid to go to the doctor because they can't afford to pay the cash out of pocket that will relate to the deductible. They've spent $14,000 or $15,000 to have health insurance, or $10,000, and now they can't afford the deductible expenditure, so they don't go to the doctor when they need it unless they're desperate. And that's why the emergency rooms seem to be our place of first. So my sense is that even though we might have a bunch of people who are insured, we don't have many people who feel they actually have access.
Yeah, there's three important things here that all mix together in that comment. One is people are not incented to be well. There's very little incentive for that other than your own altruistic motivation for yourself. And that is that it's only recently that companies or insurance companies, employers have started to pay for true wellness programs and to get people to be conscious of actual wellness.
Jan, we're going to we have to go to break. This thing gets segmented into pieces, so we're going to our first break here. But when we come back, we're talking to John Hopkins, who's talking about the healthcare system, and in particular, we're going to get to a business model for the healthcare system that I think has a great deal of potential for a lot of listeners. We'll be back. Good morning, Sandy Williams, sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show. Calvin, how do people call into the show if they want to?
That will be 844-967-2789.
Call in if you want. We're talking this morning about healthcare, and I've got John Hopkins on the line. John is discussing, we're discussing some of the ways in which the healthcare system is broken, and we're going to shift gears in a little while over to some ideas about different ways that that members of the public could pursue healthcare in a manner that might be more beneficial to them and maybe to the healthcare system at large. John, you were summarizing and started out by pointing out that in the current healthcare system, the patient is not particularly interested in his own wellness. There's no one else in the system that is incented to promote for that patient their interest in wellness, and so wellness is left up to each individual without any sort of a boost or assist or advice from third parties, right?
That is true, and in many cases, the wellness programs are something that a company, as an employer of a person, pays for. And we have this somewhat perverse system in the United States where the employer is responsible for your health care. And it has its roots in the history of insurance, which is originally when people first started becoming of employees of companies in the 19th century. If you weren't able to go to work, nobody could take your place. In cottage industries, you know, your brother could jump in, or your wife or your kids could jump in and take care of it for you. Working at the Ford factory, you know, you couldn't just have somebody else show up. And so if you missed work, they would you could buy insurance that said, well, we'll pay your day's wages if you miss because of illness. And companies started offering this insurance, and we've evolved finally into this system where somehow your employer, if you have one, is responsible for your insurance. And if you don't, you're sort of out on your own. And individual health care is extraordinarily expensive, and as most people have found out. Now, the ACA helps that out a little bit by providing some incentives to buy health care and to offer some assistance for those making lower wages that are unable to pay the very high premiums that come along with self-insured individuals. Now, the second part of what you mentioned is that more and more people have very high deductibles and co-payments or patient responsibilities, and they are very likely to not use up that entire deductible. Only about one-third of Americans actually exceed their deductible. And that means that basically your insurance doesn't kick in until you've exceeded that deductible, which means you're paying for your own health care under the guise of being insured.
Right. So
but the catch 22 is that pay the rates negotiated by the insurance company.
Yeah, let me just summarize that point, because I think that's pretty fundamental, is that when we buy health insurance, most of us, you know, if we buy it over the entire period of our adulthood, we're buying insurance during a period, much of that time, when we are likely to be quite healthy. And so we're going to pay for insurance, which is basically there to help us in case we experience extreme medical costs. But we're going to pay a price for that. And then we're also going to pay for the health care that we're most likely to get, which is that diagnostic care we pay for when we go to the internist to find out what's wrong with us, or the pediatrician to find out what's wrong with our children. And then we get the modest kind of health care that results from that rather than extreme health care. And so it strikes me that in today's world, people are paying for insurance, which they're not likely to use until at some point in their life when they're very likely to use it, which is later in life or after they've determined that they have a pre-existing condition. Is that a fair summary of that?
Yeah. And you, the insurance industry, like any insurance, and there's nothing wrong with insurance intrinsically. The idea is that you're taking advantage of, you know, episodic events that can be expensive, and you're covering them through a series of shared payments.
Yeah, you're spreading the risk. You're spreading the risk a bunch of people. Yeah,
a bunch of people and over many years. In other words, if I pay into an insurance plan for 10 years and only use it one of the years, all those other premiums help offset the cost, and that's the way insurance is designed to work.
Like automobile insurance.
But just like automobile insurance.
Right.
And it's designed to take care of things that you don't want to happen to you, but sometimes do. And so right now, our insurance system is set up, it would be as if the Ford, motor insurance company said, you know what, I'm going to encourage you to have crashes rather than being a good driver, because I make a lot of money when I fix your car. So I'm not really interested in you being a safe driver.
Yeah,
I should say that in public that I'm interested, but in reality, I make a lot of money when you crash your car.
Because your premiums go up. And when everyone's premiums go up, we get to keep more money as profit out of it. John, we're gonna go to another break in 2 minutes, so maybe we can try and get through these couple of points before we get to the break.
Yeah.
Well, the next point.
The final point is that with the being self-insured, we don't have the option of looking for the lowest cost provider. We are told you have to go to a provider in order to accumulate your expenses against your deductible. You have to go to the providers that we tell you to,
right,
and you will be charged at the rates that we have negotiated.
Right. So the healthcare providers,
go to a provider and say, I want the lowest price.
Right. So you don't, you know, there's something wrong with your liver. You find out you have to go to whichever hospital is covered by your provider, and that provider is only going to receive what the healthcare insurer decides they're going to receive, and so the whole system is outside the control of the patient, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll be back very shortly after the break. We're going to talk more about this. We also have Dave from Mequon on the line. We'll be talking. We'll be bringing him into the conversation. We'll be back. Good morning, Sandy Williams, sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show, Wednesday morning. We're talking to John Hopkins. John is an expert in the area of healthcare, at least in the area of providing service to healthcare. He's a software service provider, and I wanted him to, talk to him today because he's involved with providing at least the software service associated with a business model in healthcare that I think can be very responsive to problems that are experienced by the general public about our healthcare system. And what we've talked about so far is pointing out that patients don't have much to say about the healthcare they get. They're basically directed by insurance providers if they're wealthy enough or in a position to have insurance. They're directed by the insurance provider to the healthcare providers. Their healthcare providers are not particularly interested in their wellness. The insurance provider is not particularly interested in cost controls associated with the healthcare, so that the nation is experiencing immense healthcare costs. And with respect to individuals, healthcare insurance is quite expensive, and many people during the middle period of their lifetime can expect to be quite healthy during the year. So there are plenty of people in the economy who are willing to roll the dice and take the risk on not having health insurance because they don't want to pay $10,000 a year for $12,000 a year for health insurance that has a $5,000 deductible. So they're going to have to spend $17,000 in a year before they pay for before they get insurance coverage for any of their medical costs, when in fact they expect that their medical costs in a year might only be a couple of thousand dollars, if any at all. So we have a lot of people in the public who aren't covered by insurance, or if they're covered by insurance after they pay for their insurance premium, can't really afford to pay the deductible. And I'll bet you Calvin and other people we might talk to would say that they really avoid going to the doctor because, one, they can't afford the doctor bill, and two, they couldn't afford the medical bill they would get if the doctor told them there was something expensive that they needed to have done. And so, you know, many people in the ages of 25 to 35 are currently rolling the dice and are without health care. And I think you're involved with a process that is different than that kind of medical insurance. What you've talked to me about involves medical insurance, but the patient plays into that system differently. Can you explain that briefly?
Yes, there's the notion of direct primary care, which is this idea that you pay a subscription to a provider, and they provide basic primary care to you on a walk-in basis, with some additional cash charges for additional services or products. And the important distinction here is that you pay for those individually out of your pocket. And the platform that we have started to build encourages people to support their own healthcare by finding the lowest cost provider that will accept cash and to pay for their healthcare directly. And the result of this is that you're connecting the provider and the patient or the consumer directly. And it's allowing the patient to make that value decision, saying, hey, this is a good doctor, he's a reasonable price, I'll go here. Our longer term.
Well, just a question. Just a moment. Under what you're talking about, though, this prudent patient would get health care insurance, but it would only be for more catastrophic kinds of health care costs. So they might get umbrella health care coverage that would cover mm-hmm. health care costs when it exceeded like $20,000 a year or some such number, right?
Right.
And there is that kind of insurance available.
The purpose of There is. There are people that will write policies for truly catastrophic care. They're basically acting as the reinsurance for you.
Right. And that,
you're insuring
that,
yourself.
And that insurance would be much less expensive on an annual basis than the kind of insurance that's being acquired
that's right.
now for $5,000 deductible coverage that is costing $10,000 or $12,000 a year, right?
Right, because the number of times you actually have a catastrophic event is pretty low. And in fact, you're trying to avoid it, typically. You know, you don't want the branch to fall on you or to have a massive heart attack. And if you were to incur a lot of these costs, you say, wow, I should really be taking better care of my heart here if I don't want to have to pay for a very large bill. And that's usually what drives us in any consumer relationship is we go, wow, that's really expensive. I should take proactive measures to avoid having to do that. And that's really where the free market notion comes in, which is I'd like to buy my health care the same way I buy virtually everything else in my life, which is to make value comparisons.
Right. So
how much am I willing to pay for a certain product?
Yeah. So to summarize, though, it struck me when you were telling me about this, that what is particularly intriguing about this is that if someone is currently buying health care insurance and they're 35 years old, they're going to be asked to pay a premium of $10,000 a year, and they're going to pay, mm-hmm. have a $5,000 deductible policy. Is that about the right numbers for the kind of coverage, or
right now, under the ACA Bronze Plan in Wisconsin is terribly expensive in general.
Yeah,
you pay about $1,500 a month, and you have a $10,000 deductible with a $20,000 family limit on that.
So that's
so
$1,500 a month is what $18,000 a year.
$18,000 plus the $10,000, so it's $28,000 per year. Now, if you're making $40 an hour. That's mm-hmm. $80,000 a year, or let's say you're making $30,000 a year. That's 100% of your income.
Right.
Now, the ACA provides for supplemental.
Limits
assistance in
yeah,
that,
yeah.
and they help you pay for that. But you have to demonstrate that. You know, that
so,
you can't just say, "Oh, I need the assistance." You have to actually demonstrate.
Right. So taking numbers like. Let's just use $18,000 a year, and let's say $20,000 round numbers, which is less expensive than it would happen in a family in Wisconsin. It sounds like for a family in Wisconsin with Bronze, which is not the best care, best kind of insurance, it would be $28,000 a year before you start getting insurance, actually the insurance paying for a bill in your family. So that family, that family could enter into this direct payment program. And they could spend, so long as they spent less than $28,000 in a year, they'd be better off in $28,000 all in, including the insurance premium for their catastrophic coverage. They'll be better off taking the risk onto themselves and paying out of cash out of pocket on the occasion when they want to go and get a diagnosis and get health care. And if they have something serious wrong with them, they'll have the protection of this catastrophic health care umbrella that they have that will take, so they aren't going to go bankrupt because of health care, but they also are going to not have to spend every year in and year out, $28,000 a year or $18,000 a year. Let's say that they don't experience any health problems. They're spending $18,000 a year and not using any health care at all. In that same circumstance,
right.
All they would spend in that year would be the cost of their catastrophic coverage. What's a bogey for that? $4,000?
Yeah, that's a lot less, and it depends. The plans are few and far between that provide that capability.
Yeah.
Because the insurance companies primarily they're playing the arbitrage.
Yeah, they want the profit of covering all that stuff. But so let's just use a number like $4,000. So if you spend $4,000 a year on catastrophic coverage, you can have $14,000 a year of out of pocket costs before you've spent as much money as you would to have insurance, and under that insurance, you wouldn't have had any health care costs at all because you're spending $18,000 without your deductible. You'd have to spend $28,000 a year for the health care that you would have gotten for the $10,000 of out-of-pocket costs. And with your out-of-pocket costs, it strikes me that the program you describe helps the professional, the professionals who at least are in this program of operating independently, because they're not under the thumb of a hospital. They don't have a headcount requirement per day. They don't have a 5-minute limit imposed on them for time they can spend with patients. They're working for themselves. Cost control wise, you've introduced into the system the cost control that's going to be caused by people making decisions about spending their money carefully, right? So when I'm spending my money out of my pocket,
that's the key element.
Yeah. And
that is the key element. When people talk about reducing healthcare costs and they say, "Oh, we're going to save 10%," 10% is nice, but it doesn't change an industry. You wouldn't suddenly, go to a different restaurant because the meal is suddenly 10% less. But if it's 1/10 or 1/100th, now things change. And in a competitive environment, people start to create incentive. They're now incented to come up with procedures and devices that are orders of magnitude less expensive in order to be competitive. But if you're going to be reimbursed for basically whatever you charge, what's the incentive for lowering the cost?
Yeah.
A stent is $90,000.
Yeah,
it's because it has to be, but we don't know that.
Yeah, so this whole system struck me as particularly enticing, also because there is available the health savings account under the tax law, so that people, an individual, I think it's $3,500 a year, or a family, I think it's $7,500 a year, can put money aside for health expenses every year and put it aside pre-tax. So it's like setting up an IRA. And the IRA, however, needs to have needs to be devoted to health expenses until you turn age 65. But it creates a pathway for avoiding taxes for health expenses. It also provides a way to accumulate health expense money so that in the several years in which you don't incur any expenses, you are at least accumulating an expense fund, so that in the years in which you might have health costs that would be coming out of pocket, you've put the money aside and you didn't have to pay taxes on it.
Right. And this is a societal benefit in that healthcare is somewhat unique in that a healthy population benefits everybody, just like education. An educated population benefits everybody.
Yeah.
And so we want to encourage people to be healthy, not just have health care. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of this, which is if they are incented to pay for their health care on their own, then they're going to be incented to take care of their health in the long run. Now, this is a huge societal change. This is not Uber happening in a period of 4 years,
right,
replacing taxi cabs.
Yeah.
This is a generational change. But the current process that we have in place is literally not sustainable. The country will go broke, and I think no one disagrees with that statement that I know of.
Yeah.
On either side of the aisle, or on either side of the insurance versus the provider versus the patient, they're simply not sustainable.
Well, and I think
so we do need to come up with a better system.
Yeah, I mean, we can all see the train wreck coming, and the question is whether we'll adopt policy. But this struck me as a market response that could operate faster than the political response and could overcome the power of the insurance lobby, because the insurance lobby can't stop this from happening so long as people realize the benefit of it. And there will be plenty of insurance companies who will be interested in at least covering that the extraordinary insurance costs, because that'll be the part of this market that's available to them.
Which in theory is more profitable. If you are truly only handling the extraordinary events, you can charge a more profitable premium. It will be a lower premium, but more profitable.
More profitable.
And Dave, you're only dealing with extraordinary situations.
Yeah, Dave from Equin, I'm sorry we've had you wait. As soon as we get back from this break, we'll bring you in. We're talking to John Hopkins, talking about a healthcare system change, at least something that individuals, listeners in the audience, could implement themselves, and that if it took hold, could have a significant change, make a significant change in how we individually bear health care costs and how the system responds to health care. We'll be back shortly. Good morning, Sandy Williams, sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show. It's Wednesday morning. Calvin, how do people call into the show?
The number is 844-967-2789.
We've been talking to John Hopkins, who's calling. We're talking about the healthcare system, and we're talking about a particular business model involving people directly purchasing healthcare from people who are from providers who are willing to essentially take their cash, to take payment directly. It circumvents the insurance process, at least for the first $15,000 or $20,000 of health care costs that a family might experience. And then there would be insurance coverage for costs above that. It could greatly reduce the annual costs for most families, the families that are typically during their healthy period of their lives. And it could benefit the whole system by creating more focus on wellness, which is good for everybody, but it is also good for the healthcare system and the total costs of that are contributed to healthcare and the GDP. And it could also put cost controls on by causing the consumer to be making wise economic decisions, wiser than these third-party payors have been. John, I'm going to ask Dave from Mequon to join us. Dave calls in with some regularity. Dave, how are you today?
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call, Sandy. I'm doing pretty well, actually. So that's a good thing. I just wanted to fill in a few things because I have a little different perspective on things, obviously, in talking to you over the years, Sandy. We have to remember this was considered the Affordable Care Act that was passed under President Obama. And obviously, with your friend being on the radio here today, he's pointed out that it's not affordable. It's done the exact opposite. And part of that is due to the fact that if you look prior to the ACA law coming into fruition, you were allowed to buy at least policies from different county lines if you wanted to within your own state. Today, you're not allowed to do that. If you live in Milwaukee County, you cannot buy a policy or potentially that would, let's say, that would serve Ozaukee County. So you're limited to the county. So what that does is it actually shrinks the ability of actually having competition. And so you only have a couple of plans to choose from, and you have different variations. You have bronze, silver, and gold. And then, of course, you could always get a health care plan through your some companies do provide assistance with that as well. However, you know, at the end of the day, I think what would be most beneficial into rectifying this is because the government in a way has created this mess to begin with.
Well, Dave, let me slow you down a little bit, though, because
sure.
I mean, the problem with insurance involves the size of the pool. And automobile insurance doesn't get terribly expensive because it's mandatory, basically mandatory for you to have automobile insurance in almost every state. And so because everybody has it, there are many, plenty of people who don't have accidents who have health insurance. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, it was possible for insurers to not cover people with pre-existing conditions. They could restrict their pool to a healthy lot of people. And so they were basically selling insurance to people who didn't need the insurance as much as potentially other parts of the insurable pool. And so, you know, the most fundamental part of the Affordable Care Act in terms of it being a premise that might work was the mandate that everybody have insurance and that the pool would therefore include both the healthy and the unhealthy in it. And so that all got changed. And when that changed, the potential for the Affordable Care Act to create affordability with respect to insurance went down. So, you know, I think we can connect dots about what happened before and after, but we have to connect all the dots. And I think that's a pretty important dot to connect. We do have another caller who's called in, Robert from West Dallas. And so why don't we make this a three-way? And Robert, what are you calling in about?
Good morning. Really, I had a question, but I also have a comment based on what Dave just said. One of the number one drivers of healthcare expense and bankruptcy in the United States was during the Bush administration. They basically changed the law that say that government will not negotiate lower drug prices, which makes no sense. It's the largest buyer of drugs, Medicare and Medicaid. It would make sense if we believe in capitalism and a free market that they would negotiate these things just like the VA does. But really, I love the concept. My question is more around the wraparound policies. What are the names of some of the companies that offer that, or where can we find more information about that?
That's a question for John. I think you're asking the umbrella policy. Are they available,
right?
and where might they be found?
To do that is if you talk to your own insurance broker, they will have relationships with companies that provide that capability. There are several of them. I don't have any specific reference to them. And they're typically provided as part of a larger benefits package in companies.
Yeah, I would point out that this business concept, this business model that John has described, is almost identical to the Singapore health system. And the Singapore health system is frequently pointed at as one of the most successful national healthcare systems. And it involves essentially health savings accounts. It involves for the public to pay for the first portion of the health care out of their own pocket. If they don't have any money, there's something like Medicaid that steps in, and the government steps in to pay for that for those who can't afford it. And then there are tiers. There's a tier of insurance above that. And they have accomplished very good healthcare outcomes with a reduction in healthcare costs nationally that has been accomplished. I guess we already have another break. These things come very quickly, Calvin. We'll be back shortly. John, just hang on over the break. I just want to finish this process with you.